Hello, my name is Claude Warren, and I'm here today to talk about multidimensional bloom filters. By way of introduction, you can see on this slide, this is my email, GitHub links, several other links as well. I want to note that this presentation has more information than I'm actually going to discuss, but it is here for background, so you can download the presentation and explore the background information at your leisure. So first, I'll give you background here. We're going to talk about the what a bloom filter is, and have examples of bloom filter usage in modern software, explore what multidimensional bloom filters are, some performance analysis of the various implementations of multidimensional bloom filters, and some recommendations for when different types should be used. And this presentation does have all the references cited listed at in the end. Okay, so what is a bloom filter? It is a probabilistic data structure defined by Burton Bloom in 1970. And virtually every bloom filter paper or talk you encounter will have that statement in it. Basically, you can think of a bloom filter as a bit vector. And you take an object, you hash an object, you create, from that hash you determine which bit to turn on, you create another hash of the same object, and you turn on multiple bits within the vector, and that represents the single object, and then you can merge those together using OR logic across the bits to create bloom filters that contain more than one thing, and then you can ask if something, if a bloom filter is in some other bloom filter, so by looking at the intersection and seeing if it lines up. This test will yield a false positive, but it'll never yield a false negative. So these are typically used when you want to know if you're doing some processing and you might have an expensive function that you can skip in certain cases. If you can build a bloom filter to test when you should make that call, then as long as you can deal with false positives, then you can use that test to see if you should make the expensive call. You can basically think about using a bloom filter anytime you can frame your question as, is A not in B? So bloom filters are defined by four properties. You've got P, the probability of the false positives, N, which is the number of elements that the set represents. So how many things are we going to put into the bloom filter? That's the N. The magnitude, or the number of bits, and K, which is the number of hash functions that each item going into the bloom filter uses to turn on bits. That's the number of bits, effectively, we're going to turn on for each item. Now, Mitzmacher and Upfall have shown that there's a relationship between these properties, and they outline them as four functions, which are listed here. And Thomas Tirsch provides a good online calculator, you know, where you can explore the interplay between the various values. So, as an example, let's assume we want to put three items into a filter with a 1 in 5 probability of collision. Calculations then yield an M of 11 and a K of 3. So we're going to start with cat. We're going to create a bloom filter for the word cat. And we're going to do this using a CRC hash and what's called a combinatorial hashing algorithm. So the CRC hash, because it's quick and easy to do, we'll use that. Most people use like a Murmur 3 or something like that. You don't need to use an encryption level hash. It's extra overhead that you basically don't need for the functionality. So take the CRC for a cat, and we get this nice long string here, which we can then split into and interpret as two unsigned ints. So we have FD26 and 15C4. So the combinatorial hashing algorithm says we take one of those, so we'll take 5572, 15C4, and take the mod of the width. So mod 11, it gives us 6. So we're going to turn on bit 6. Now we need to generate our second hash value. So we take the other half of our CRC hash and we add it to the first half, and that gives us a new value, and we then calculate the mod 11 of that, and that gives us 0. And then for the third one, we do the same thing again, and that gives us 5. The three bits are 0, 5, and 6. We turn those bits on, and that's our bloom filter. Okay, so we can do the same thing for the dog and guinea pig and put them all together into a collection. So now our collection has the values 0, 2, 5, 6, 7, and 10. And now we can ask if things are in there. So we're going to ask if a horse is in the collection. We do the calculations for horse, and you come up with 2, 5, and 9. So now what we do is we ask, is 2, 5, and 9, and intersect that with the set for the collection, and see if what we get back is the set for horse. And in fact, what we get back is 2 and 5, so it is not the set for horse, so horse is not in the collection. Okay, now we have an example here of a false positive, which I'm going to skip over. So we want to talk about statements about bloom filters. Well, what do we know? Well, the number of bits that are turned on in a bloom filter is called the cardinality, or the Hamming value, or weight. The number of bits that have to be modified to convert one bloom filter into another is called the Hamming distance. If you know the shape, so you know the magnitude and the K value, the number of functions you're going to execute, then you can estimate the number of items that are in the filter. You can estimate the intersection, the number of items in the union of two filters, and you estimate the number of items in the intersection of two filters. The other thing is that items cannot be deleted from the standard bloom filter. You can only add. If you want to delete, then you have to reconstruct it from scratch. There are several specialized bloom filters that solve this problem, but we will not be discussing them today. So I do want to introduce this concept of saturation. So saturation is a measure of the number of items in the filter relative to the number specified in the shape. So for cat, we said we were going to put 3 items in. So when we get to the collection was built, that had 3 items in it that had a saturation of 1. The cat itself had a saturation of 1/3. So the saturation then is how close are we to the limit, or are we over the limit of what we said we were going to put into the system, into the collection. Now, this table shows we generated a million filters using GeoNames data, and we indexed the name, the country code, and the feature code. So 3 items in a million. We wanted a probability of collision of 1 in a million. So I gave us an M of 72 and a K of 17. Now, this table shows that at a saturation of 1, we have the probability that we were looking at. It also gives us some information about where the mean and median number of Hamming values are and the standard deviation. But we're really interested in the probability over there at the end. So, as we see, at a probability of a saturation of 1, the probability is 1 in a million. When we get to a saturation of 2, the probability has doubled, or has not doubled, it's increased by two orders of magnitude, more than doubled. When we get to 3, we've increased by 2 orders of magnitude again. So you can see that very rapidly the probability falls off from what was expected. Now, if we get up to 5, then the probability of a false positive is so high that it overwhelms the probability of a positive. So you, at that point, the bloom filter is basically useless. So now I want to talk about a gatekeeper and a gatekeeper bloom filter. And this, if you've used bloom filters at all, this is probably what you've used bloom filters for. So in this case, the bloom filter is an index of all the items that you're putting into some collection. So typically, you'd create a bloom filter that had an N of 10,000. A probability of 1 in 10, and then you would create a hash of some object matching that, and you'd add that to the gatekeeper and put that object in the collection, and then you continue to do this. You could put 10,000 objects in the gatekeeper in the collection, and then everything would be fine. At 10,000, you reach a saturation of 1. So then what you do is you want to know if something's in that collection. You build its bloom filter, and you do the check against the intersection, against the gatekeeper, to see whether or not your object is there. like I said, this is the standard use for Bloomfilter in most software. So you'll see this if you want to find files on a storage device, for example. You might create a Bloomfilter that contains the names of all the storage, all the files, and then you could check to see if the file was there without having to actually go and search the storage. You could determine which network nodes, for example, have a specific service that offers specific service, so you can figure out which one was closest or something like that. It's also commonly used in joins where you create a Bloomfilter for one side of the join table, one join, and then as you're adding or checking against the other side, you build the Bloomfilters and check against the gatekeeper to see whether or not you actually want to go in and read the entire table and do the join, see if the join is in there. You can also use a gatekeeper for sharding data across collections. So in this case, you might have multiple collections with the gatekeeper in front of it. And then when you go to add an item, you calculate the distance, the Hamming distance, between the Bloomfilter for the item you're adding and the Bloomfilters in front of each of those collections. And whichever is the smallest Hamming distance, that's where you put the object. Now, it has some interesting properties. You can add additional collections at any time by adding an empty collection with an empty filter, and it'll start to populate that. If you have a collection that's full, so we've said, you know, you're only going to do 10,000, you set the gatekeeper at 10,000 objects, then 10,000 item goes in, you can now remove that collection from consideration for insertion, but it can still be used for query, so you can answer queries with it. And redundant storage is fairly simple, because now you say, well, if I want, you know, I want it written n times, then I can find the n lowest Hamming distances and insert into those. So this brings us to multidimensional. What is a multidimensional Bloomfilter? Realistically, a multidimensional Bloomfilter is a collection of Bloomfilters. And the list of gatekeeper filters that we used for the sharding, for example, is a multidimensional Bloomfilter. But the question we want to ask when we start to look at implementations is there an efficient implementation? And efficient is defined here as the search time is less than O of N. And the reason we're going to pick O of N is that the simplest multidimensional filter is a list. That's the one that everybody uses. So that's if we make an improvement on that, then we have a solution that should be considered. The other thing that happens here is when we get multidimensional Bloomfilters that are efficient, we can now start talking about reference Bloomfilters. And they're different than the gateway filter. So a reference filter is designed to identify a single object by unioning the hashes of multiple properties. So when I create a reference Bloomfilter, for example, for a geoname item, I take the name and the country code and the feature code, and I generate a Bloomfilter for each of those, and I merge them together and create a reference Bloomfilter that has an N of 3 and a very low P. So we would have, an N of 3 and a P of 1 in a million. And that would be the size we use for the geonames filters. The gateway filters, on the other hand, you have an N that's very large. For example, you might say I'm going to have an N of a million, and you'd have a P that's very large as well. So you'd have a P that's, you know, 1 in 10. Those tend to be much larger Bloomfilters. They have a much larger M associated with them, and then the reference filters. But the reference filters are more compact. They have a higher cardinality with respect to M, so they have more bits turned on with respect to the size of the filter itself. Now, reference Bloomfilters are interesting in that they can be used to index encrypted data, so you can allow searching without decrypting. You can provide multi-column indexes where you can query any subset of the index columns. You can perform a master index as a data set. So a number of things you can do with reference bloom filters. I have a discussion here about how to write the multi-column, but basically what you're doing is you take each of the properties. As I said, you create the bloom filter for each of those properties. You merge them together. That's your reference filter. You're going to write that into storage and then get a unique identifier and associate the unique identifier and the bloom filter together in the multidimensional index. And then to read, you basically do the same thing. You're going to look at what property values do you want to query. You put those create bloom filters for each of those, merge them together. It doesn't have to be the full set. It can just be one item if that's all you want, one property. Merge those together anyway, get a reference filter, and then ask the multidimensional filter for matching filters. You can then get the unique identifiers back for the storage layer, pull the data back out of storage, and filter out the false positives. So the thing to note is that read operations don't support OR. It's just the AND. The read operations don't support ranges or inequality. And a note here that bloom filters are always created from plain text. So let's look at a couple of implementations. Bluefy is one of the earliest implementations, and it mixes the gatekeeper strategy with the sharding of properties to implement a B+ tree. All of the bloom filter nodes that you're indexing are on the leaf nodes, and then the inner nodes are basically gatekeepers that reference those leaf nodes. This works well if what you're indexing are the keys that you put into the gatekeeper itself. So the Bluefy represents an entire gatekeeper. So it does not work well with reference implementations because the saturation becomes too dense too quickly. Second solution is a tree solution where we take nibbles or bytes, break the bloom filter into nibbles or bytes, and then use each of those to index into the tree, to build the tree index. This suffers from an expansion function where every zero in the target that you're looking for expands into two solutions. So if you're looking for nibble 0101, 01, that expands to the four sets that you see here, 0101, 0111, 1101, and 1111. All have to be searched, and that occurs at every level in the tree. So hamming is another possibility. The thing to realize here is that no bloom filter can match a bloom filter with a lower hamming value. And the other thing to realize is that if you consider the bloom filter as a very large unsigned int, no bloom filter can match a bloom filter that has a smaller integer value. So we can use the hamming weight and an estimated log base 2 to filter out bloom filters that won't match, don't have the capability of matching because they're too small. The log base 2 is easily calculated because we have the bit vector. So it's very easy to do that. We can implement this as a skip list or multi-segment key in a standard database. What happens, however, is that it only filters out about half the filters in the case because of the shape of the data. And finally, we have the flat Bluefy, which creates a table with one row for each bit in the filter and then a column for each filter in the index. Basically, they're bit-wide columns, so you just turn a bit on if you get the bit on in the filter that you've inserted there. Now, if you want to find what filters match, you simply look at the bits you've got enabled in the filter you're looking for. You pull those rows out, you AND them together. If anything is left on, those are your solutions. Okay, so for our experimental data, we built a framework to capture load, query, and delete timings for various bloom filters and various capabilities. The reference bloom filters were done from geonames using name, country code, and feature code. The feature code we used as a low cardinality search, and the name is a high cardinality search. The gatekeeper data is simply the geoname ID, and then The population is the size that we were looking at, and the p is 1 in 10. Okay. And now what we find is that if we look at the gateway, this is the load times. And so the lines at the bottom are the linear. So that's the list and the array implementation. And as you can see, for loading, then nothing's going to beat those. When you look at the gateway, the tree are the two yellow and orange lines there. And as you can see, we can only load 1,000 of those. When we tried to get to 10,000, we ran out of memory. So they are memory intensive for the gateway, and they don't work well. And in fact, as you can see, they take forever to load. The other three are the Bluefi, going from top to bottom, Bluefi, the flat Bluefi, and the Hamming, and they all load up to 10 to the 4 filters in the gateway. And as you can see, they take significantly longer than the index, the flat linear. If we look at the reference indexes, again, the linear is faster, but the other ones tend to cluster together. So there's not a whole lot of difference. The trees are a little bit faster than most of the others, with the exception of flat Bluefi in some range. So if we look at the search times, this is for the gateway searching, and again, the trees are pretty useless in this case. The linear search, as you can see there, splits the trees nicely from the other three. And then Bluefi is very fast, as we would expect. The Hamming has basically the same search pattern as the Bluefi, although it is slower. And the flat Bluefi is again faster than linear over the over the ones we were able to search. Now we look at the cardinality, the reference searches. We had three searches. We have a low cardinality, a high cardinality, and a complete. And the for low cardinality and the high cardinality, the linear still comes out ahead. In the low cardinality, the Bluefi is the second best option or third best option, and the rest of them cluster together. And then when we get into the high cardinality, Bluefi and flat Bluefi do well. Flat Bluefi actually gets better than linear when we get up to a million records. And then finally, in the complete, this is the point at which the trees absolutely shine. They are faster than the linear. That's the only time we see anything other than that one case of flat Bluefi that is faster than linear. And then, indeed, in this case, the Bluefi is also faster than linear for most of the case. So we need to look at deletion. So deletion times, the Bluefi is the slowest, and the reasoning for that is that it has to do a rebalance of the tree as it deletes. So it's a more complicated process and slower. However, it is not much slower than the linear, and that's true in all of the three cases of the two cardinalities and the complete. The linear is, as you expect, a linear case. The Bluefi, the flat Bluefi, performs better than linear. It's not, it looks like it becomes linear toward the end, as we get up toward the million. The last three point data points there look like it might become linear. The Hamming and the trees are much better. They are basically an O of one for deletion, which is what we expect based on the implementation of the algorithm. So, so where does this leave us? Well, if your application continuously builds and drops multidimensional bloom filters, like for join processing, then the use of a list or an array is recommended, because the load overhead in the other solutions will probably negate any query performance benefits. Second is, you want to determine the type of bloom filter your application is using. And if you're using gateway filters, don't use try. And if you're, you might consider using Bluefi. Otherwise, you're probably going to want to stick with linear. if you're using reference filters and you're generally searching for a complete set, that's where you want to consider using try implementations. If you're using reference filters and you have partial, you're using partial filters for querying, so you know that most of your queries are not complete, then you might want to look at using the list or the array, the blue fee with a flat blue fee. And if you have reference filters and you're updating them, so you're doing a lot of deletions and inserts, then you might consider using something like the tree, the Hamming, or the flat blue fee. And that takes me to the end of the presentation. The rest of this is the references. So if you have any questions, I'm here to answer them. And thank you for attending.
Okay.
We should be live soon.
Yeah. Are we live? Yeah, we must be live.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we are live. Yeah.
So the question, there was a question about, let's see, where else, what other areas have Bloom filters been applied to? And the one that comes.
Okay. We should be live soon.
Are we live? Yeah, we must be live.
Yes. Yeah, we are live.
The question there was a question about where else these have been used, and the one that comes to mind is the there's a couple of them actually, but a lot of the browsers use Bloom filters to filter out URLs that are known to serve malware, so they create a big Bloom filter, gateway Bloom filter, and we type in your URL that checks it against the Bloom filter, and if it matches, then they make the expensive call back to the server to see if it's actually in the list of bad, you know, of malware. It's used in genomics. They use massive Bloom filters in genomics to find genes that are adjacent to each other, or patterns that are adjacent to each other. And to be honest, I have read those papers a couple of times, and I always get lost, because I just don't understand genomics well enough, I think, to understand what they're doing. But I know that they use very large Bloom filters to filter out genes and things like that. And then I recently implemented a multidimensional Bloom filter as a Cassandra index, because Cassandra, you know, allows you to index one column and do things like that. And what we want to do is be able to encrypt data and then be able to query it without decrypting. And so by building a Bloom filter index on Cassandra, we basically use one column for the Bloom filter, and we build an index in the background. And then when you query, you can query any data that's been merged together into that Bloom filter in a single query. So you can we can answer questions where we're looking for a couple of different column values at one time. And those are the ones that I can think of off the top of my head for other areas that they've been used.